I have seen requests for me to increase my microphone. I will try to speak louder. So let me tell you a story. This is an old story. It's from the book of Exodus, from the Hebrew scriptures. When the Israelites first escaped from bondage in Egypt, they traveled in the wilderness under the leadership of Moses. And on the third new moon of their travels, they reached Mount Sinai. There, it is said, God spoke to Moses and told him that the people should stay at the foot of the mountain, but that he, Moses, should climb to the top, where he and God would speak some more. According to the book of Exodus, Moses made several trips up and down the mountain. In one interpretation of the text, when Moses comes down the mountain the first time, he tells the people of the Ten Commandments, one of which is, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." From a secular perspective, we can understand this commandment partly as a way that the Israelites were trying to distinguish themselves from other local religions, which definitely had altars set up for various deities, some with idols or standing stones or markers in trees, or other figures indicating that the location was sacred or special. Now, the last time Moses goes up Mount Sinai, he stays for 40 days and 40 nights because God had a lot to tell him about how the Israelites were to live and how they should worship. And while Moses is away, the people come to Moses' brother Aaron and they say, "Look, Moses has been gone for more than a month, and at this point, we're not so sure about his leadership. And actually, we're not so confident anymore in this God we've been following. So, Aaron, could you maybe come up with some other gods that we can follow?" So Aaron collects gold from everyone and melts it all down and casts it into the shape of a golden calf. And the people say, "Great, this can be our God who rescued us from Egypt." And after making offerings to the golden calf, the people started to celebrate. So you can imagine when Moses returns from his 40 days up on the mountaintop, carrying two stone tablets on which the covenant between God and the Israelites has been inscribed by the very hand of God. And he sees the people partying and worshiping a literal golden idol, which was one of the very few things he had told them specifically not to do. Well, you can imagine how he was a little miffed. So he took the golden calf and he burned it with fire. And then he ground it into powder. And then he scattered the powder on the water. And then he made everyone drink the water. They knew how to express their frustration in biblical times. Now, there are various ways that you can look at this story, historically or religiously, but one of the possible meanings is a claim about human nature. It's really hard to keep people from worshiping idols of some form or another. Now, in recent weeks, as I have seen the videos and read the stories of protesters physically removing statues of people, I've thought about this story from the book of Exodus, because idols still play a role in our lives, not just in the form of objects or statues that we venerate, but also in the form of ideas and beliefs that can feel as immovable as if they were made of stone and bronze. And this morning, I'd like to explore that idea a little bit more. So let me tell you another story. This one is more recent, and it's about me. And before I get to the story, I want to tell you a little about my personal theological perspective. I figure that since I am going to be your minister for at least a year, I should let you know something about where I'm coming from. So I'm the youngest of seven children, and we were not raised in any religious faith. My family celebrated Christmas and Easter, but as purely secular holidays. Christmas was about decorating a tree and exchanging presents and visiting with grandparents and aunts and uncles. Easter was about baskets full of chocolate and more family gatherings. The only times I went to church as a child was when I was playing in a piano recital. My parents were secular humanists before that expression was widely known. But by the time I was in high school, I and they would have called ourselves that. Now, I'm still a humanist, although now I would say that I'm a religious humanist. And I call myself an atheist, by which I mean I do not believe in anything that I would call God, leaving open the possibility that I might believe in something that you would call God. I put it that way because I would much rather have a conversation about what you do or do not find divine, instead of arguing about what you or I should label ourselves. Now, I bring this personal history up for two reasons. First, for those of you in the congregation who are humanists or atheists, I want you to know that when I bring up a story from the Hebrew or Christian scriptures, I am not trying to convert you to theism because I myself am not a theist. I use these stories because they are integral to our history as Unitarians and Universalists, and people have found meaning in them for thousands of years. Conversely, if you are a Christian UU or a Jewish UU, or otherwise find meaning in these scriptures, I want you to know that I treat your beliefs with respect and that I take these religious texts seriously for what they tell us about ourselves and our role in the universe. So the other reason why I've mentioned my theological background is that it is a prelude to the story that I will tell you now. So I entered seminary in 2014, and I knew that I was going to be spending 4 or 5 years in serious study of religious matters. I entered seminary because I wanted to become a minister. I wanted to change the way I looked at the world, the way I interacted with people, the way I was involved in social justice, the way I experienced spirituality. And I remember thinking one morning in my first semester that if I really wanted to be open to this kind of change, to this kind of ministerial formation, then I would have to accept the possibility that maybe, perhaps, just possibly, I might end up believing in something that I would call God. My view of myself as an atheist had become an idol in my mind, something I viewed as impossible to change, as fixed as stone and bronze. And consciously letting go of that self-conception was both freeing and frightening. It was freeing because if I was not tied to that part of my own self-image, who knows where I might end up? And it was frightening because if I was not tied to that part of my own self-image, who knows where I might end up? As it happens, after 4.5 years of seminary and many other kinds of ministerial training, I still see myself as an atheist, as I explained earlier. But because I had been open to the possibility of change, my understanding of my beliefs and of myself could grow in new and unexpected ways. What about you? What parts of your own self-image seem to you as if they are fixed in stone? And do they seem that way because they are truly a part of who you are? Or are they idols, things that you have only convinced yourself are unchangeable? I'd like you to take a moment just to think of some things about yourself that you think are unchangeable, but which maybe aren't. Now, on this 4th of July weekend, I find it incredibly encouraging that America itself is engaging in this kind of self-reflection. It's taken the form of protests and marches for the Black Lives Matter movement and in the form of tearing down literal idols. People in southern states are asking, of all the historical figures that we could honor with a statue in the state capitol, is a leader of the Confederacy the best choice? Here in California, our history is different from that of the South, but we've had our own forms of violent conquest and oppression. And here, too, statues are coming down. The people who built those statues intentionally made them of stone and bronze, seemingly immovable, designed to be idols. But what we are seeing now is that people are willing to believe that they can move the immovable and change the seemingly unchangeable. And that change is happening. Now, you might object that tearing down statues is a purely symbolic act. But I say that symbolic changes are important. Sharon Welch, in her book, A Feminist Ethic of Risk, writes about what she calls the despair of the middle class. And what she means by that phrase is this: when people who are not directly affected by an oppression feel that political change will be difficult or impossible, they despair and give up, even if in principle they would like to fight against the oppression. This despair can be dressed up fancy as sophisticated political realism, but in truth, it is nothing more than a way of giving up. And this despair, this giving up, is part of what makes it so hard to fight against oppression, to make positive political change. When giving up is easy for a large group of people, nothing will change. So these marches and these rallies, like the ones that were held just a few weeks ago and have been continuing in Santee and other places, these protests against police violence, these statues of Confederate leaders and of Junipero Serra that are coming down, they serve a purpose. They can give us hope for change. It is not a coincidence that public support for the Black Lives Matter movement has increased as much in the first half of June as it had in the preceding 2 years. It's because of hope. It's because of visible symbols of change. And once change is in the air, who knows where we might be able to go? How can you play a part? A positive part in America in this historic moment. One thing you can do is to become more aware of the intellectual idols in your mind. When someone suggests an approach to a social problem that seems outlandish or unrealistic to you when you first hear it, and yet you keep on hearing it discussed, that suggests that maybe there is an idol in your thoughts that is keeping you from considering serious change. In her book, The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander writes about her own experience with this. More than a decade before writing her book on prison abolition, Alexander saw a sign on a telephone pole while rushing to her job as a civil rights lawyer. The sign compared the war on drugs to Jim Crow. She thought to herself at the time that this was just an absurd comparison. But as she looked into the matter further, and as her job shifted from employment discrimination to criminal justice reform, she changed her mind about whether it was realistic. For people like me, who have had few interactions with law enforcement officers, it's easy to dismiss the recent calls for defunding the police as ridiculous. Who will protect people from violent criminals? But when you read what scholars and activists have been writing on the subject for decades, when you read Michelle Alexander and Angela Davis and Alex Vitale, you find that many of the questions that come up have been answered, and that drastic changes to our law enforcement system could actually be made. This is just one example, and there are many others. We owe it to our country. We owe it to all who live here. We owe it to our consciences, and we owe it to all that we hold sacred, to tear down the idols in our thoughts that are keeping us from greater justice. So, yes, celebrate the 4th of July weekend. Enjoy whatever apple pie you have left over from last night. But as you enjoy the sweetness of the pie, taste the tartness as well. Think of the people for whom 1776 did not bring freedom. Think of those who had to wait 86 years longer for the Emancipation Proclamation. Think of the enslaved people in Texas who weren't told of their freedom for more than 2 years after that, because it was not profitable for their so-called owners to do so. Think of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, except for those convicted of crimes. Think of Jim Crow. Think of Frederick Douglass and Langston Hughes and James Baldwin and their words. Think of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and their movements, and William Barber and the current movements. Think of Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland and Trayvon Martin and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and their deaths. The American Revolution did not create freedom and equality for all. It was a first step for our country on a long road towards equality. And first steps deserve to be celebrated. But we've got a long ways to go before we reach that promised land. America has wandered in the desert much longer than did Moses and the Israelites. May we tear down the idols that are keeping us from taking the next step towards freedom. Amen, and blessed be.